It's the New York Ska Jazz Ensemble with In Motion. It's from their 2011 album, Double Edge. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. The February primary elections in Nevada will be the topic of our second half of the program today. But first, let's go to Haiti for an update. Hillary Clinton's handpicked president of Haiti, Michel Martelly, as you know, prohibited by law from seeking re-election after his five-year term, unwillingly left office on February the 7th, leaving behind a leadership vacuum and a nation mired in poverty, corruption, political chaos, protests, and partisan violence. Haiti's parliament named Joselin Privert, president of the National Assembly, interim president on February the 14th, and immediately he began talking about putting the nation on the right track. But Kim Ives, our guest today, editor of Haiti Liberté, reports that many are concerned about Privert's ties to Washington. Thanks so much, Kim, for being with us. You are our scholar in residence on the issues arising out of Haiti. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Well, thanks, Eutrice. It's an honor to have that title on your show.
Well, what is going on here? Why is there concern about Privert? But before we get to that, tell us about how he came to power.
Well, he came to power through an OAS, Organization of American States, broker deal, whereby the parliament, which itself is very much in question, the same election that gave rise to the crisis in the form of a challenge to the Martelly successor, that is Jovenel Moïse. It's the same election that gave the parliament, or that part of the parliament that is now voting, and a lot of those races were very much in question, very, very fraudulent on surface at least, and need to be investigated. But nonetheless, the OAS turned to this parliament to take the president of the Senate, Joselin Privert, and make him the interim president. The opposition, it should be said, in the form of what's called the Group of Eight, that's the eight runner-up presidential candidates, or the parties of the runner-up eight candidates, along with the Haitian Constitution, called for the president of the Supreme Court to be the interim president. That would be the constitutional approach, but as usual, the international community, that's a euphemism that we should avoid, in fact, we should be saying Washington, basically put its foot down and said, no, we're going to use Privert. Now, Privert's background, we should say, is really one which is quite diverse, even though he's identified because he was a high-profile minister in Aristide's government, in the government which was overthrown by a U.S.-backed coup. He was the interior minister. So he's identified with Aristide, but the fact is he's really come through quite a long political a journey. He was the tax collector, or a tax collector, for the regime of dictator Jean-Claude Duvalier up until 1986, when he was driven into exile. And he then became, as we say, a minister in the regime of Jean-Bertrand Aristide. I'm sorry, I'm on the street, so you may hear a couple of car horns. He then went to prison after serving as interior minister for Aristide, was in prison for 2 years, uncharged, or untried, I should say. He was charged with involvement in the 2004 skirmish that happened up in St. Mark, which they tried to call a massacre. Even the UN has dismissed that charge. And then he became an advisor and finally a senator under the party of René Préval. So he's really a gadfly politically, and it's very hard to say where his allegiance lies. However, we at Haiti Liberté at least believe that his principal backer at this time is really Washington, who sees him as a compliant partner, as he has often been seen as sort of a moderate in the Lavalas sector, at least.
Well, very noteworthy is the silence of the State Department under John Kerry, being critical of the elections in Haiti. Is this a carryover of the Clinton administration and Secretary Clinton?
Yes, I think so. This is very much the Obama policy has mirrored the Clinton policy. Kerry policy has mirrored the Clinton policy. They essentially turn a blind eye and give full support to Michel Martelly, or gave him full support, and now have intervened to once again essentially trample the U.S., the Haitian Constitution. He has shown support for this unconstitutional result, which is the parliament, this rump parliament, putting in place Prévert. And so we can really say it's with the same arrogance that the U.S. government is continuing to meddle in Haitian affairs.
Well, I made that notation because Kerry has been quite vocal about elections and corruption in Ugandan elections, and critical of the now president again, Yoweri Museveni, saying that the situation is intolerable and undemocratic. And I wondered how he was able to make that distinction as it applied to Uganda, but all of this drama unfolding right in our backyard, and not a word.
Exactly. And this is just the point. It's, as they say in Creole, deux poids, deux mesures, two weights, two measurements. They are very hypocritical when it's situations which serve their interests to speak out or meddle. They will. But when it's clearly something which is going to harm their interests, as in the case of Haiti, they don't want to shake up the arrangement they've made. So they're very mum on any criticism. They had been very mum of any criticism of Martelly, and basically we can say their approach to each country is different. We see how they in Africa to have gone after many of the leaders there, whereas in the Caribbean, in particular in Haiti, it's a complete a blind eye.
Prévert has 120 days, as I understand it, to basically organize new elections that will then elect a permanent president. Is this, from your point of view, based on what you have been observing and the complications that arise, especially within the Electoral Council and within the National Council and other systems of government, is it possible that this could happen in 120 days? And how is it shaping up so far?
Completely unrealistic, completely, and already Prévert has requested an extension. I think we're looking at an unstable period for at least a year, at least, and it may be more. In as I said, I think on our last show that we did, it seems to be cycles of 30 years. In 1956, there was a similar upheaval. which resulted in about 2 years of provisional governments in 1986. Jean-Claude Duvalier was sent packing in a similar upheaval. It was 4 years before Jean-Bertrand Aristide was elected. And I think now we can look at a year or two or maybe more of basically power struggles as the different classes in Haiti seek to direct the country down a given road. 120 days, yeah, it's completely impossible. The U.S. point man on Haiti, a guy called Kenneth Merton, he's called the State Department's special representative to Haiti, held a telephone press conference last Wednesday, and he made it clear that as for the U.S., they consider the completely defunct election of Jovenel Moïse and Jude Celestin as still viable. The State Department is still talking about going forward with that. They are not even talking about this verification committee, which is sort of the half step that the opposition has proposed, independent verification commission to review the election. But the Haitian people themselves are going much farther and just saying, throw the whole thing in the garbage. This is a complete joke, a mockery of an election. So we can see the U.S. Continues to hope that somehow they're going to snatch their own victory from the jaws of what is clearly a growing defeat. So in any case, the short answer is no. 120 days is completely unrealistic.
There seems to be a kind of a perfect storm of chaos going here. We have the internal situation. We have Martelly, the handpicked president, handpicked by Hillary Clinton to be president, a nightclub singer who basically left the country in ruins. We have now this interim President Prévert saying, I'm going to take a look at what I inherited, and with the eye toward prosecution, one assumes, of all those responsible for corruption. And yet he, too, has been stained with that that corruption charge as well. We have the people distrusting just about everybody in this thing, including the Organization of American States and other international efforts to certify that the elections went well. We had members of the Congressional Black Caucus going down when the election was being held or not being held, coming back and saying nothing, really, about what they observed. So it seems as if there's just a perfect storm of just total chaos. Is there anything in sight that suggests that you know, there's a light somewhere at the end of the tunnel, and it's not an oncoming train?
Well, let me just make one very quick historical zoom out and zoom in, just so the listeners can make a little sense of this chaos. Essentially, after Haiti's revolution in 1804, again, the first independent nation of Latin America, the third republic on earth, the first black republic, two ruling classes emerged, the big landowners and the comprador bourgeoisie. And basically for the first 111 years of Haitian history, they exchanged power through elections, not direct elections. It was always the parliament who appointed the president, or coup d'etats. And then in 1915, U.S. Marines entered, and so a third player came into the struggles for power, the U.S., and they essentially put a headlock on Haitian affairs for 20 years as the Marines occupied the country. And they put in puppet presidents, U.S. puppet presidents, really up until 1946, when the big landowning sector had Dumas Estimé come in. Dumas Estimé and the other presidents basically exchanged power, those from the bourgeoisie exchanged power until François Duvalier came. and he declared himself president for life. That takes us up to 1986. And finally, Jean-Claude fell. So the fourth actor in this, the Haitian people, really didn't come onto the stage till 1990 when they elected President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. After that, the U.S., the big landowners, and the Haitian bourgeoisie all got together and they said, this is our main enemy. We have to unite to fight the people. And really what we've seen for the past 30 years, Utrice, is the U.S. with the big landowners and bourgeoisie trying everything to stop the popular candidates, the people's candidates. And so this is the fight that is going on in Haiti. The Haitian people have stood up and they've blocked the U.S. Big landowner bourgeois plan to kind of put in their candidates, and they're saying, no, we want ours. And it's hard to say which way it'll go. This is, again, a hemisphere which is had Venezuela and Bolivia and Ecuador and other countries of the continent find a way through elections to have some kind of political revolutions. We see one maybe going on here in the United States with the candidacy of Bernie Sanders. So we'll see what happens in the coming weeks.
One of the people one would have expected would have had a much larger profile in all of this is Jean-Bertrand Aristide. He was put in a way, with U.S. support. He was taken out and then put back in again with U.S. support. Right. So why is he so quiet? Why the low profile?
Well, it's two things. I think on the one hand, Aristide was put back in 1994 after the 1991 coup against him by Bill Clinton, who was trying something new. He was the first and last president to ever put back a leader who'd been taken out by a U.S. coup. But he brought Aristide back to basically lead a neoliberal reform regime in Haiti, which Aristide said yes to formally, but he tried to undercut it and basically undermine it. That's using the traditional Haitian resistance method called marronage or sort of double talk. So the U.S. got very mad at Aristide. They kicked him out again, as we saw, and sent him into 7 years of exile into South Africa. But in South Africa, Aristide was very, I could say, affected by what he saw there with the ANC and the role of Nelson Mandela. And I think that's really the role he sees for himself, is a kind of Nelson Mandela role. He doesn't want to get into the hurly-burly, nitty-gritty trenches of Haitian politics, but he wants to stand as sort of a moral figure above the fray, if he can. And so I think this is one of the reasons why he measures. He only speaks when he absolutely has to, and when he does, therefore, it's sort of like a thunderclap. We'll see what happens. But he's also, I should say, not to go into too much detail for the listeners, but, you know, he's really, again, an apostle of Toussaint Louverture, whose vision was essentially to find a way to get the European or colonialism in Toussaint's day to accept him as the ruler of what he saw as to be a French colony. So he didn't see a complete break with the French empire, and Aristide doesn't really see a complete break with the U.S. He would like to reach a deal with the U.S., but they're never going to accept him. And so that's why I think, in a way, the Haitian people are looking today for a more radical solution, something along the lines of Jean-Jacques Dessalines, who made Haitian independence. So they're looking for a more Dessalinian solution, not a Toussaint Louverture solution.
Also keeping a very, very low profile, in fact, insisting on having practically no profile at all, are the Clintons. Where are they in this turmoil in Haiti?
Well, I think they're just having an ostrich policy. They're hoping that it doesn't come and bite them in the rear end. They realized that, I think, and we'll see with the Hillary emails about to be released, the ones that had been classified, if some of those contain some interesting Haiti insights. But definitely the Clinton White House, the Clinton Secretary of State, as Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, played a role in getting Martley illegally installed in 2011. They may realize that this will be a tremendous liability if it comes out. We know that Bernie Sanders and her are now going to be fighting it out on Super Tuesday, where the black vote will make a big difference. You know, you can imagine if the news came out that Hillary basically sabotaged the election in the first black republic in order to, you know, install Martley. If that news came out, this really might affect the way some of the black Democratic base would vote. So I think they're hoping that the Haiti situation doesn't blow up on them and hurt them.
I would like you to kind of give us, you had done an analysis of the emails, and there was a very peculiar characteristic to it, Hillary Clinton's emails. Could you take us back there a bit and tell us about these emails and what they did in fact show?
Well, the emails really showed, we did both the WikiLeaks ones as well as Haiti Liberté, as the listeners may recall, did receive the 2000 Haiti-related documents of WikiLeaks, and we showed how Hillary basically was very intent on controlling the narrative of U.S. involvement in Haiti in after the 2010 earthquake. But the more recent stuff that came out, kind of the juiciest morsel, was a letter from Chelsea Clinton to Hillary basically saying, listen, our earthquake response here is a joke. It's totally ineffective. The people are don't know what's going on. They're not involving the Haitian people. We're riding roughshod over them. But there was, interestingly, a gap, and I wrote a piece on that, a gap that happened really right after the first round of the 2010-2011 election. In November 28, 2010 was the first, and shortly after that, there's a sudden gap in the emails. We don't see anything. And when we were dealing with the WikiLeaks emails, we noticed that there was a gap in them, really covering the 2004 coup d'etat, basically, from 2003, when the trove of emails that WikiLeaks got began, until 2005 was when we started to have Haiti emails. So we assume, and Julian Assange told us, that he believes that this was because the classification of those emails was higher, that it was top secret or even higher classification, instead of just the secret and classified that we had gotten. So our assumption is that this is the reason why there was a gap in the emails, and we'll soon find out if that's the case, because as I just said, the classified emails have now been ordered to be released, and we expect that any day now.
And in the meantime, Haitians are still angry and they're still protesting at her headquarters in New York City, demanding to know where $6 billion in rebuilding money went.
Correct. And this is, of course, one of the great crimes which the Clintons were, we could say, an accessory to, was that the Martley government disappeared millions, or we can say billions of dollars, not just in earthquake aid, but in money from the Petro Caribe Fund of the Venezuelan government gives Haiti its oil and gas products. They are then sold, and about 60% is paid, but 40% is basically put into a huge account, which is paid back over the course of 25 years at 1% interest, something like that. So this money, this huge pot of money from the Petrocaribe sales, all of this was also pilfered by the Martelly government. So you saw the earthquake money, the $6 billion, in fact, even more, it was closer to 10 in the end, along with the Petrocaribe money, was all spent. And one of the things that Prévert did say in his press conference on Friday was that he was going to do an audit, because right now the Haitian government doesn't have a penny. Martelly left without leaving the government completely. All the state coffers are empty. So where did all this money go? That's the big question. And the Clintons have a hand somewhere in providing the answer.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Kim, for bringing us up to speed here. Now, you know, this is fascinating information, which I you know, is not readily available. Of course, you've been writing about this for quite some time. But here we have an election. I'm coming to this in the second half of the program today. Here we have an election, and the African Americans who are out there stomping for Hillary are making absolutely no connection, no link whatsoever between what she has done, she and Bill have done in Haiti, and the current march toward the White House. They're making no connection whatsoever. And we have to insist that these things are not to be forgotten. These are very important things. So I want to thank you for the work that you do. You let us in on the details that we need to know. And I am so thankful that you're so readily available to us here. And you do a great job of explaining the significance of Haiti to us all. Thank you so much for being with us today. How can people get more about the story that you write?
Well, yeah, thank you, Yatrice. And again, thank you for offering us a microphone to inform people. But they can find out more if they'd like by going to read on the Haiti Liberté, that's Haiti Liberté with an E on the end instead of a Y, .com website. There is an English section where, in fact, improving our website to make it even more user-friendly and easier to read. So feel free to go there and catch up on the situation in Haiti and our analysis of it, HaitiLiberté.com.
Thanks so much. Thanks again. We'll take this break and come back and talk about what happened in Nevada right after this. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Yatrice Lead. And where we just left off is where I want to start. And that is the coverage of this campaign focuses attention only on what's happening within the borders of the United States, and barely even that. And when it comes to Hillary Clinton and the Clintons, period, there is no effort, really, from the so-called media establishment to subject this campaign to any deep scrutiny. They just about elevated the main actors, the people who have emerged as main actors in this awful play, and they created a Donald Trump who won the Republican contest in Nevada, and his ilk, Hillary Clinton on the other side of the aisle, who won Nevada. But of course, the Nevada primary was literally race to the finish for both Republicans and Democrats. And this is what I want to talk about today. The elections in Nevada netted wins for Donald Trump and for Hillary Clinton, and it dealt a fatal blow to Jeb Bush's candidacy, but it also brought home incontrovertible proof that race really does matter in America. And on both sides, this was what made the election turn out the way it did, and we can expect more of the same as Super Tuesday looms and the other primaries ahead of that, all the way to November. Hillary Clinton won because black people supported her. It was the black vote. It was also the Latino vote. So black and brown people, the people who are seldom part of the equation, those are the ones who brought home the prize for Hillary Clinton and, to a large extent, to Bernie Sanders. The race rested on them. And whites brought home the vote for Donald Trump. It's as simple as that, and as complex as that. This has nothing to do, really, about merits of anything. It has to do with an understanding, a very deep understanding here, without people wanting to admit it, that in this country, everybody understands what the rule is, what the order is, what the standing operating procedure is. It's all predicated on race. Donald Trump, as I've said before, and the Republicans generally, used race in a matter that created, or that just, it didn't create it, it played upon the fears, the primordial fears of whites in America about the business of losing ground, whites feeling completely fearful about the transition, the inevitable transition that this country is making, in which whites will be, by 2032, I talked about it, the minority population here. Intensely resented, which is one thing. Anger at losing ground and fear, an unspeakable, indescribable fear that they can never turn the clock back once this happens, and it's right around the corner. Most of the things that Donald Trump is saying are coded. This is coded language. Fear of the other or the others. The people who are just making a mess of America just simply by being, by living, by existing. And now by multiplying. You hear the phraseology all the time. Our way of life, our American values. These are the threats that they have pandered to and they have fed with their invective. The media has just decided, well, you know, he's just being obnoxious. They're just, you know, saying bad things, behaving a little badly. But other than that, he's a nice guy. And so is Rubio, and so is Cruz. They're just fighting to claim a prize, that's all. These kinds of things happen in a political contest. So we have fear and hate commingling. And the language is heavily injected, heavily infected with it. Media access, they don't understand this. This isn't really happening. They're just, you know, a slip here or there, an error in judgment here or there. But other than that, it's really just politics. And they cover it up and tell us about the latest polls and what the polls are showing and the different groups and the issues that pertain to those groups and so forth. And these candidates are, in one way or the other, just trying to appeal to the disparate groups that they're going to be looking for political victory from. No. This is the standing order. People understand it. People know it. This is what it is to be in America. It comes out because the big prize is very, very important. And now we come to the reality of what limits will people observe in pursuit of the big prize. And we are seeing very few. They go to the sure thing, and the sure thing is race. The sure thing is race. The Republicans' philosophy essentially is we are here and we are going to fight tooth and nail to maintain our way of life. If that's not coded language, I don't know what it is. Our American values are at stake. We have to fight to reclaim, in effect, our white supremacy. White supremacy is in danger. And we are trying our best. And you can look to us, you can be assured that with the Republicans in office, we will reclaim what's ours. We won't let them overrun us. We won't let them spoil our way of life. We won't let them take America from us. We will see to it that we maintain supremacy. That's the coded language. On the flip side, you have different versions. Hillary Clinton suddenly is, she's a sister. She's damn near a sister. In the same way that Bill became a brother. All he had to do was pick up a saxophone and put on some shades and, you know, make a vapid effort at playing the instrument. And people ate it up. Stereotypes. Let's pander to stereotypes. And the stereotype works. Black people want white people to love them. You don't have to do anything. You don't have to give them anything. You don't have to, they don't even demand anything. Just show up and love us. Show that you love us. Show that you care. And you'll be all right. You're all right with me. Now, meanwhile, they have a knife at your neck and another at your heart, but another in your back. But there is this psychological yearning for validation as supremacy dictates. Hillary Clinton was in trouble until she realized just about a week or so ago, a couple of weeks at most, I've got to rev up the old black talk. Otherwise, I'm not going anywhere. These people need to hear me. They need to see me as being very, I'm one of those nice white people. Some of my best friends are black. I love collard greens. You know, and this is what is at the root of a whole bunch of black people appointing themselves as ambassadors. They can't wait to just put their coats down over the mud of their constituents so that she can have a nice walk straight to the White House. We just finished talking about Haiti and her role there and the Clintons' role there, which is just about, I mean, how much more do you need? Here's a person who is literally under FBI investigation. Again, we have so much bad stuff associated with the Clintons. But we have these treacherous people being her advanced men and women coming back to their communities, invading people's quiet time at church on Sunday to tell them that the most important thing in their lives is to vote for this horrible woman and support the Democratic Party. Bernie Sanders also has caught up with this racial issue. Bernie Sanders was reluctant to deal with it, completely reluctant to deal with it openly until he got confronted by Black Lives Matter. Instead, he decided that he was going to take the safe ground. We're not going to recognize race. Well, there's a little problem here, but we can fix that. But overall, he says his message was, it's class. It's a class issue. The big banks versus the little guys. The elite versus the working class and the non-working people. So he too was talking in coded language until recently. Now everybody's talking about all the things that matter about black folks, and they're all pathological. Everything they have to say about blacks and Latinos is about pathology. Prison reform, which, by the way, is a critical sector of the economy. It is part and parcel of the U.S. economy. You would think that we would have a recognition of that and an analysis as to why this is the case. Instead, we have people raving because Hillary says, oh, it's time for some prison reform. Nonsensical. Completely stupid. They're not talking to African Americans about the issues that matter to African Americans. For example, the inability to accumulate wealth, let alone to transfer that wealth, like Donald Trump. Donald Trump. It wasn't too long ago that Hillary and Bill, neither of them belonged in circles of whiteness, but they're very white now. So white, they live in restricted communities. I talked about the fact that all of the candidates so far have literally deracinated themselves, removed every possible impediment to their claim of whiteness. And that includes candidate Carson, the lone African American left standing, barely standing. It's the same thing Obama had to do. to deracinate himself, to make himself appealing, to overcome the morbid fears, but still telling people we're all one family and all this nonsense. No, we're not. The issue is nobody is going to deal with the problem. It's not in their best interest to do it, but it is in their best interest to signal that they are still, no matter what comes out of their mouths, they're very much obedient to the system, which demands subservience and demands supremacy. Demands subservience of all people who are not supposed to be in the circles of power. So that's why when we hear about Hillary and Bernie Sanders, we're getting the silliness of whether it's going to be a competition between the first white woman or the first woman president, or whether it's going to be the first Jewish man. No, I want the first, the most competent person who has a long history of being plain, being dedicated, being clear about a system and what must be done. To his credit, I will say that Bernie Sanders has at least been articulating this longer than Hillary Clinton has. But I still have big problems about the fact that it has taken him this long to take the risk of putting his money where his mouth is. Telling people the issue is class. And if we deal with class, we automatically deal with race. It's a silly argument. It doesn't hold water at all. And it's a cowardly way to talk. We've had enough of cowards. Which brings me back to these ambassadors that are trolling for votes for this system. This is the time when communities of color in particular have to do some heavy editing. Anybody coming to you telling you vote for Hillary Clinton in particular, vote for this Democratic Party, you should say no, I'm out of it. By the way, you see, this is the first, I have to address this because this is a long-standing myth. These elections are being situated in a way where people is thinking, these are national elections. No, they're not. The elections held nationally, that doesn't make them national elections. This is party business. This is the duopoly taking care of its business. The Republicans are trying to figure out who among them is going to keep you in line. And the Democrats are doing exactly the same. The parties are having their structured arrangements have nothing to do with you, except they would like, you know, you to bless the process by participating and making it look real. But this is party business. I've talked about delegates and superdelegates and so forth. The parties are taking care of their business the way they always have. In order to produce the person most emblematic of their philosophies, their ideologies, their agendas, their ways of doing things. Trump says, that would be me. Hillary says, that would be me. I can do business the Democratic way better than anybody else. But these are people taking care of party business. You have no benefit to derive yet. Now, comes November, there will be a general election, and supposedly that is the contest that would matter to see who will ultimately prevail. But we know the system is rigged. The system is rigged. It is crooked. And this ought to be the watershed year for people to say, I'm out of it. I'm about doing things in a different way. I'm about seriously connecting with my interests and pooling my resources and my time and energy with others who are similarly situated, who are like-minded. I'm out of that. I'm not going to bless this horrible system with my vote. I'm not going to do it. So everybody understands it's about race, except you and me. We don't act like we understand it. And tomorrow, I want to follow this up because we have to deal with this right now, right here, right now, this year. This is a watershed moment, I think, for the communities of color in particular, but for all like-minded people who see the system for what it is and what it's doing. And who should be about the business of finding a different way to operate? Formulating an entirely different way to go. We shouldn't care about the Democrats and the Republicans. We should call to task the Green Party. And we should build alternative parties all over the place. You should also serve notice on the people who have been elected on the strength of Black and Latino votes, on the strength of the people who are oppressed in this country, and who are now telling folks, support a system that means you no damn good, that won't deliver anything to you but misery. Trust us, we know better than you do. And we're telling you the Democratic Party is where you ought to go. And we know that you are lemmings, you don't have a brain, you don't have a mind, you don't have independent thoughts. We just show up and we surround Hillary Clinton. She is the goddess. And we tell you what a great person it is and what a great person you would be to anoint her as your leader. And you think that in this year, this watershed year, when the system is reorganizing itself, which is to say it already has planned what it has planned for you and me, it already has that on paper. And we're sitting around talking about whether, well, it's you know, a really interesting contest, and we like, you know, we're encouraged to be like fans watching a sporting game of some sort when our very lives are on the line, and we are encouraged to aid and abet our own annihilation. Something is wrong here. So I'll continue this tomorrow. And I want to literally reemphasize these points because these things are connected. No person of conscience hearing what you heard here today, again, and we've been doing this on a continuing basis to educate people what your interests are, what our shared interests are, and how important it is that we should build communities of resistance. It's the only way we will get through it. They will not link Hillary Clinton with Haiti. And no person of conscience, no politically aware person could ever say, well, it's okay. Yeah, she did that, but that's Haiti. And, you know, there might have been reasons, but she's all right with me. And anybody telling you Haiti, and despite what you know about Haiti and the Clintons, that it's okay to support that and to support them, you automatically should shut that down. So I thank you for joining me today. I thank you for your company. Stay tuned. Keep it right here on PRN.FM. Let me know what you think. Send me a note at leadstories@gmail.com. And as always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. More tomorrow. Bye-bye.